I don't know what your knowledge of music is, and I imagine in the church at the moment there's a variety of people with a variety of knowledge, not knowing exactly what Lambro and the guys are going to present. I've got a bit of a feeling of which way they're going to go with tonight, and I'd imagine that if some of you do have knowledge of any music, even of Western music, so to speak, it will be a helpful framework to understand some of the concepts. Years ago, when I first started learning the basics of Byzantine chant of the church, I've learned at a very basic level, but I did have a background of knowing and playing Western music, and I could read the notation reasonably well. And when I was first introduced to Byzantine chant, the first thing that took my attention was how foreign it all looked. I thought it was Arabic writing, to be honest, when I first saw it. So I think you could be excused if you think that the first time you see Byzantine notation. But once learning a little bit of the basics, one thing that impressed me about Byzantine chant and the notation was that although Western music was fantastic for showing you how to perform a piece of music on an instrument, it wasn't as good as Western notation as what Byzantine notation is in showing a singer how to sing intricacies. Like, for example, in Byzantine notation, as Lambro may cover tonight, you can actually tell someone to sing in between what we know as half notes, semitones. You can't do that in Western notation, at least not simply. And the other thing is some of the inflections and the things that they tell in Byzantine notation for the singer to, or the chanter to do, you simply can't do it as effectively in Western notation. You might have the odd grace notes and whatever, but you can't do it as well, I think, from having learned a bit of both. And so for singing, I've come to realize Byzantine notation is a very effective notation. I've even seen Western tunes written in Byzantine notation, like songs, I don't know, let's say Waltzing Matilda, for example, written in Byzantine notation, and it's an effective notation in showing you how to sing when you want to put particular intricacies that you can't normally do with West. I don't know what intricacies you want to put in Waltzing Matilda, but anyway, in case you did, you could do it. So, for what it was worth, I thought I'd mention that to you, and if you have even a little bit of knowledge of music, generally speaking, I think that will help you and understand. The other aspect of it was what we call the tones of the church, or the ichos in Greek. That's a very foreign concept. If you've done any Western music study, it's very similar to what we call the modes, the modal system. If you've done any jazz studies or anything like that particularly, you'll definitely know the modes. And it's something similar to that, but it's not quite the same. You can't associate scales and modes or keys or whatever in Western music to what's referred to in the Byzantine notation as tones. And the best description I've thought of myself to help me understand it was, I think of sound patterns. When I think of a Byzantine music tone, I think of sound patterns. And Lambro and the boys will show us what that means tonight when we look at the variety of tones in the Byzantine notation. Heavenly King, Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, present everywhere and filling all things, the treasury of good and giver of life, come and dwell in us and cleanse us from every impurity and save our souls, gracious one. Please be seated. Welcome again. And I'd like to welcome on behalf of all of you, Lambros Vlachondonis and the chanters that he has with him. Thank you, Lambro, for being with us this evening.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming out tonight in this rather balmy evening to come and listen to me present a short overview of what Byzantine chant is, or the music of the Orthodox churches in general. Just a disclaimer, I'm not qualified in European music, so therefore I will not be able to go into a lot of depth about the differences. If anybody does and wishes to make a comment towards the end of the evening, by all means please do. For those of you that obviously do know and have studied European music, so we can perhaps address some of the major differences in it. To Two kinds of music exist in the world today, secular and religious. Each of these has been developed by different feelings and different states of the soul. Secular music expresses worldly feelings and desires. These are usually of a romantic, sentimental, or idealistic nature. The music of the church, however, expresses contrition, humility, suffering, and godly grief, which, as Paul says, works repentance to salvation. Religious music can also evoke feelings of praise, thanksgiving, and holy enthusiasm. Secular music, on the other hand, even in its purest form, expresses worldly or carnal emotions, even when it is inspired by suffering and affliction. This type of suffering, St. Paul calls worldly grief, which works death. Only church chanting or music can uniquely express the spirit of our religion, because only this music has an absolute and most faithful connection with it. The fathers of the church ordained that Christians use the voice alone in execution of hymns. However, in order to satisfy people and flatter their tastes, the Western church and all the sub-branches of that put instruments inside the churches, disobeying what was ordained by the fathers, who forbade the use of musical instruments during services. They did this because they had no idea what the difference was between liturgical music and secular music. But the Byzantines distinguished the one from the other, and this shows how much more spiritual they were in comparison with the Westerners, and how much more truly they experienced the spirit of Christianity. Since this distinction was formed during the early years of the Byzantine Empire, historically, that's how liturgical music became known as Byzantine music. Byzantine chant is monophonic, in other words, chanted in one voice, constructed of melody alone, in order to convey the meaning or intent of the prayer or text which is being sung. This melody is accompanied only by a bass drone or isokratima, which enriches the chant by adding seriousness and power to it. Even when many people chant together, the resulting sound seems to be coming from one mouth. This simple combination of melody and ison, or isokratima, is a practice that has been in use for centuries and continues up until today. Byzantine music itself is peaceful, sad but consoling, enthusiastic but reserved, humble but heroic, simple but profound. It has the same spiritual essence as the Gospels, the hymns, the Psalms, the books of the lives of the saints, and the iconography of Byzantium. That's why Byzantine music sounds boring for one to whom the Gospels are boring. However, it is joyful for one to whom the Gospels are joyful, and peaceful for one who experiences the peace of Christ. It is the music that the saints found most appropriate for communal prayer and for expressing Orthodox theology. The music that the representatives of Prince Vladimir of Russia heard in Constantinople in the service that made them exclaim joyfully, "We knew not whether we were in heaven or on earth. We cannot forget that beauty," and thus led the conversion of Russia to Orthodoxy. Byzantine music expresses gladdening sorrow. Its melody is meek, humble, and sweet, but with a certain bittersweetness, full of repentance and mercy. It bestows a divine glory upon souls that have become worthy of the eternal mysteries and the compassion of God. It expresses thanksgiving. It causes the flow of tears of gratitude and spiritual joy. This music is the warmest, the most direct, and the most accurate expression of the religious feeling of faithful Orthodox people. Just a brief historical overview. When Christianity was established as the official religion of the Roman Empire, the church acquired new and impressive buildings for worship. The rites and ceremonies of imperial Christianity took on the solemnity and the grandeur of court ritual. A rich tradition of hymnography developed. Poets, composers, and singers brought their skills to the service of the church. These people of the church were people of exemplary faithfulness, people such as Saint Romanos de Milovos, Saint Ephrem, Saint Cosmas, and Saint John of Damascus, which we will look into a little bit more detail a little further on. Their words were matched completely with the music that they were set to and were chosen carefully, not to be just grammatically sound and pleasing to the ear, but theologically precise as well. Side by side with relatively simple styles of music used for scriptural readings and the chanting of the Psalms, more elaborate melodies were composed for the church's new poetry and for the liturgical texts. In the main cathedrals and churches, the ordained singer, also known as the psalty, played an important role in the services and was expected to attain a high level of musical expertise. During the 7th century, St. John Damascene is considered to be the turning point between our ancient and modern ecclesiastical music, having formalized and renewed the sacred music and its writing system, and setting an end to any potential musical misuse that had started to become prevalent. He cleansed the chant from the improper elements of the secular music that had been introduced into the church over the centuries, without, however, dismissing the existing ecclesiastical songs which were prescribed since antiquity. As the sacred chant developed through the medieval period, new forms of notation were created to record it. The notation developed over the centuries until it became a complex system of signs capable of expressing fine distinctions or nuances of melodic movement, intonation, and expression. The fall of Constantinople to the Ottoman armies in 1453, strangely enough, brought new opportunities for the church's musicians. Their musical skills were greatly appreciated by the Ottoman sultans and the nobility. Several of the famous psalters at the time found lucrative part-time employment as court musicians. Many became experts in the Arabic-Persian music of the Ottoman court. This is what allowed our music to flourish during the period of slavery to the Turks. Not surprisingly, during the centuries of Ottoman rule, the style of Byzantine chant, always a living, developing musical tradition, took on a degree of Oriental flavor. The notation system in which Byzantine chant is recorded is linked directly to classical and ancient Greek texts and scales established in the Golden Age of ancient Greece and by scholars during the time of Alexander the Great, and then adapted for use to help the musical structure of scriptural texts. For instance, the ancient Greeks included into their music parts of music from other people, other nations, such as the Phrygians and the Lydians. They took care to develop and advance it and to give this foreign music the same character as the rest of the Greek music to become a single identity. Thus, Christianity did not limit itself with what it received from the national music of the Greeks, but it took care to transform its music to fit the needs of its divine worship, to cultivate and gradually advance it to something that provoked awe. And so, Byzantine music came into existence, a music which was shaped by the fathers of the church, and especially by St. John of Damascus, to fit the needs of our holy faith and the character of our religious poetry and hymnody. Many of the hymns chanted at Saturday Vespers and Sunday Orthodox were written by St. John himself. Over the years, eventually, the notation became extremely complicated, with signs indicating the main intervals of the melody being accompanied by a wealth of great hypostases or signs of quality, usually written in red ink, determining in great detail the precise execution of the melody. Facing the complex and difficult notation they inherited from their predecessors and an emerging gap between the musical texts used by expert psalter and the traditional liturgical melodies handed down by ear, several musicians attempted to reform the notation to produce something simpler and more spontaneous. This attempt led to the great reform of the three teachers, Hormuzios, Grigorios, and Chrysanthos, who designed a new, more simpler notation that indicates the precise duration of notes, something which was lacking in the old notation. The three teachers began the reform approximately 1840 to 1820, so only about 200 years ago, and the new notation was soon in wide use. This is the system in place for teaching and learning Byzantine chant today. Now, we should look at the Byzantine notes and scales. Byzantine chant makes use of a variety of different modes, and in order to sing the chant, it is necessary to know the different scales belonging to each mode. The modes of Byzantine chant are organized into 8 tones, or ichi, also summarily called ochtoichos. This ochtoichos, or 8 tones, follows an 8-week cycle chanted at Vespers, Matins, or Orthodos, and the Divine Liturgy. Each week begins a new mode or tone, and within that tone, texts are provided for each day of the week. The new mode begins with Saturday night Vespers and continues until the following Saturday. The first Sunday after Pascha, St. Thomas Sunday, always begins the cycle anew from the beginning. Holy Week itself has no tone assigned to it, as the natural order of things is interrupted as we commemorate the Passion and Death of Christ. While Bright Week, or Easter Week, has all the tones assigned to each day, as the resurrection is the sum of all joy. The Ochtaichos is not used on major feast days when they fall on weekdays. It is always used on Sunday, unless a great feast of the Lord occurs on that day. In the Greek usage, the first 4 tones are referred to as the authentic or Kyrie modes, or ichus, and the last 4 are plagal variations of them. This latter term comes from the medieval Greek plagios, which means side, so side tones. The 7th tone in the sequence is referred to as the grave or varisichos, and in Greek tradition, this mirrors the sound of angelic worship. So, for example, yesterday we chanted the Matins and part of the Divine Liturgy in the first tone. This coming Sunday, we will chant the services in second tone, and so on. Now, in order to be able to identify and discuss the notes of the chant, we need a way of labelling them. Syllables are used to name each tone, just as the syllables do, re, mi, and so on of the European scale are used to name the successive notes. The syllables used in Byzantine chant are as follows. As you can see here, this is just a very, very basic drawing of one of the scales in Byzantine chant. It's called the diatonic scale, which is what all students will start off learning because it is the easiest scale to pick up in Byzantine chant. And what you see there are the 8 syllables used to actually name the intervals that we actually chant. Now, this is the part where it gets a little bit more interesting. I'm going to ask all of you to join me in actually singing the scale. I'll do it first so you can hear how it sounds, and then everybody's going to join me. And then you've taken your first step towards actually learning the foundations of Byzantine chant. This scale must be learnt inside out in order for somebody to be able to progress and actually learn all the intervals and be able to put words to the actual notes themselves. So here goes. Ni pa vo ga vi ke zo ni ni zo ke vi ga vo pa ni. So very similar to the Western music notation, whoever's familiar with the scale. It's exactly the same as do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si, do. So, all together.
Ni, pa, vu, ra, vi, ke, zo, ni.
Even down.
Ni, zo, ke, vi, ra, vu, pa, ni.
Fantastic. That was great. You should give yourselves a round of applause. Not a flat voice to be heard. I think you can all come and join the classes for actually learning and start helping the church out. Now, the interesting thing to note with these syllables is that they actually utilize the Greek alphabet itself from ancient times, if you discard the bottom syllable, which is ni, which has been added to complete the scale, if you look at ba onwards, the second letter in ba is alpha. Then you've got vita in vu, gamma, delta, epsilon in ke, the second, zeta and eta. So, direct link to our civilization, if you wish. Now, church music is normally written within a range of 2 octaves or 15 notes, from low V, so where V starts, to the high V. The middle range of this, from ni to ni, is the most commonly used part of the range. That's why the scale you said before used from ni to ni. But the scale is limitless. It is only limited by your vocal range, firstly, and limited, obviously, by whatever the chant or the texts that you actually use to chant with. Now, European music or Western music uses signs which tell the musician exactly which note to sing or to play on an instrument. Byzantine notation is quite different. Melodies are written not as a sequence of notes, but as a sequence of intervals. And the fundamental set of signs it uses are interval signs. They are known as the signs of quantity, since they tell us how far to move from one note to the next. The exact interval the sign indicates will depend on the note before the sign and on the specific tone or mode in which we are singing. So, for example, if we look at the syllable V halfway up the ladder, in first tone, if we take a downward step from that, if we can visualize it as a ladder, obviously, like it is on there, it will take us to a full note down to the syllable Ra. So it's V, Ra. But a downward step of one note from V in the main mode of plagal second, or tone 6, if you wish, will take us only to a fraction of a tone, to a very, very sharp Ra. If you can hear the difference in that, that indicates the actual distances between each syllable change depending on which tone we're actually using. And that's where, I guess, it differentiates a lot from Western music. Because as Father Chris explained quite well, the Western music scale actually has only half notes and full notes. With Byzantine chant, if you can visualize it, and I didn't have time, unfortunately, to include it in the letter you sang before you, but if you can imagine, between each of those steps is like little steplets, if you wish, little minor steps, which in total, between ni and top ni, actually number 72. So there are 72 minor steps that you can actually climb when you're changing notes. So that's where the inflections, and that's why you need a very, very good ear to be able to pick up those differences and execute them. And the easiest way to do that, apart from all the theory, is to be next to a well-established or a chanter that is well-versed in Byzantine chant and listen to it by ear and pick it up in memory. Now, 10 basic signs are used in order to read these intervals. So what you're seeing here is just a very, very basic introduction into some of the symbols we actually use. And many people who see this for the first time, and especially non-Greeks, actually think it's some sort of form of Arabic writing or music. So what you have here is there are 5 signs for upward movement and 5 signs for downward movement. But you can have combinations of all of these signs. But basically, I'm not going to go into each specific quality of each of these signs, but you've got oligon, just a straight line, the petasti, or flutter, kendimata, double stitch. Unfortunately, English is a very poor conveyor of the actual meaning. Gendima, stitch, and psili or ipsili, a leap. Obviously, once a student actually starts to learn the signs of each, they will start applying the proper inflection of each of his notes, because each particular note has a different inflection. Now, when looking at these signs, for instance, the oligon, from wherever you are on the piece which you're actually chanting means a step of one, but a steep step of one, kendimata, kendima, msili, all, sorry, the first four indicate a step of one upward movement. So from knee to pa, for argument's sake, the ipsili indicates a leap of four, but never used by itself. It's always a combination note. But we'll leave it at that because it does get to get quite quite complex. These are the signs for downward movement. You've got the apostrophos indicating one note or one interval down from where you were. The elafron indicates two down, so it's a jump. So for argument's sake, you're on vu, vu, two down, ni, ipodoi, again, two down, one step at a time, and the chameli, or the low, which looks like a four, and it actually is a numerical value of four steps down. So vi, ni, just to give you, as I said, just a very basic overview of these. Now, the execution of interval signs. How do we actually interpret what we see here into actual practice? Besides the intervals that indicate how much the voice is to actually move, the interval signs also indicate the manner in which the note is to be sung. Unless otherwise indicated by a time sign, each note is one rhythmic beat in length or beat. And I'm just going to touch on just a small bracket. I'll open up a parenthesis here and just quickly mention about isokratima, which I mentioned at the start of my talk. Now, isokratima itself, or bass drone if you wish, is an important element in the performance of Byzantine chant. In addition to the psalters who sing the melody of the hymn or verse, there should normally be two or more singers who hold the ison in order to emphasize the modal structure of the chant and to give it stability of pitch. In short or slow melodies, it is possible for the isokratima to sing the words of the hymn with the psalti, but in more elaborate pieces, the isokratima is normally wordless, being sung with closed lips. The easiest way, I guess, to explain it is it's almost like a hum. The person actually doing the isokratima will hum, and you hopefully have a chance to listen to it a little bit later on. But basically, while the chanter is humming, for argument's sake, the isokrati will actually hold, for argument's sake, ni, ni, and will continue for as long as is required. Isokratima is actually more difficult to learn and to master than actual chanting itself. The reason for that is a chanter, once they obviously learn the notes, is able to follow it and actually change the structure of the piece that they're actually chanting continuously, whereas the isokrati actually has to hold one note while the psalti is singing a completely different note. So an isokrati ideally needs to be very well versed in the scale and be able to jump automatically perhaps up to 5, 6, 7 intervals sometimes if need be. So it's always said that a good chanter will also make a good isokrati. It's usually the way, but not necessarily, because a chanter may not necessarily know how to isokrati see, or vice versa. Now, what I'm going to ask is for the group that is going to be demonstrating for us not to make their way up to this solera here and take their positions, if they don't mind. Now, the group you'll actually see tonight, it wasn't perhaps the most accurate description in the advertising we did for it on the website. What you see is there are some Byzantine chanters or budding Byzantine chanters of Melbourne. Most of the group you're actually seeing are currently students of Byzantine chant, first and second year students. They are all from the parish of Bentley, where we have been running lessons there, as I mentioned, for the last 2 years. And we've hopefully been able to put together a little very, very basic demonstration of the different modes or tones that I've been talking about so far in theory. As you'll see, the ages range from about 12 to all the way to, you know, over 40s, basically. And to be honest with you, gender or age is really no barrier to actually being able to learn Byzantine chant. I'm not sure if there's a preconceived notion out there that Byzantine chant is only for men. That's not the case. Perhaps in years gone by, there were plenty of men around, and perhaps they had certain positions within the church. But there is no reason why women can't chant either, especially in our day and age where it's becoming increasingly difficult to find chanters, especially on a weekday basis. There is no stopping or no restrictions on allowing women to actually step up to the psaltery and actually chant the service from there. And to be honest with you, many times women actually learn how to chant better than men do. There you go. So what I'll be doing is running through a brief description of each tone, and then we'll be chanting a short demonstration piece of each one. So just bear with me while we get set up. Thank you. As you can see here, first tone. Now, this uses what we call the diatonic scale, which, as I mentioned earlier, is the first scale that all students learn how to chant on. Each tone can be characterized by a combination of two or three notes which stand out in the melody and which make it what it is, basically. So in first tone, the actual main note that you will hear throughout the piece is from pa. It's pa vugavi, so pa vugavi gavu pa ni pa. Now, this tone was called Dorian by the ancient Greeks, and tone one is used in some of the most familiar hymns of our church year, such as the Telepadion of the Cross, O Lord, save your people and bless your inheritance. Tone one is distinguished by what can be called a magnificent, happy, and earthy character. The first piece we're going to chant is called the Apolitikion of the Sunday Orthodox, and also chanted in the Divine Liturgy just gone yesterday. And it basically refers to Christ's resurrection. All the hymns we'll be chanting tonight are from the Orthodox service, and most of them have got a resurrectional character to them. So you can hear and appreciate a little bit more first tone. This piece is actually taken from the Passapnoaria, or Lauds, as they're called in English, from the Matin service. And again, it has a resurrectional flavour to it, talking about, obviously, Christ's resurrection. Tone 2, or second tone, was called Lydian by the ancient Greeks. Tone 2 actually comes from the city of Sardis in Lydia, approximately 670 BC. So that's how ancient this actual tone is. This tone plays a significant role in the Orthodox, as quite a few hymns are composed in it, which are chanted no matter what the ichos of that Sunday are, for arguments like Psalm 50 during the veneration of the gospel in the morning and the ex apostolaria. Tone 2 is distinguished by a languid, moving and graceful character. It can inspire either majesty, gentleness and hope, or repentance and sadness.
No. Τρίμερος ανέστης Κύριε, παρέχον το κόσμο το μέγα ελεός.
The second piece, which is very, very familiar, I'm assuming, to most people, is from the Divine Liturgy, which we chant every single Sunday, and this is always set in tone too. Τες πρεσβείες της Θεοτόκους ότε δε σώσον ημάς.
Αμήν. Τες πρεσβείες της Θεοτόκους ότε σώσον ημάς.
You'll see here, I've jumped straight from second to fourth tone. The reason for this is it wasn't actually purposeful, but would you believe it? All the infinite resources of the internet, and I couldn't actually find a piece in English for third tone. Everything else was there but third tone. So you'll have to bear with me. I'm going to chant one piece, or a few pieces, I should say, from the Orthodox in third tone. Just listen to the melody. That's what's important here, to try and distinguish the melodies. Tone 3 was called Phrygian. By the ancient Greeks, and it's attributed to Martian the Greek, brought it from Phrygia in Asia Minor. At bridegroom matins on Holy Week, tone 3 is used for the ex apostolarion, I see thy bridal chamber adored, or ton imphona sou vlepo. Tone 3 has an almost arrogant, brave, and mature air.
No. Την εχμαλωσίαν σιώνσι εξήλου εκ Βαβυλώνος, καμέ εκ των παθών προς ζωήν ελκύσον λόγιε. Οι φοβούμενοι των Κυρίων μακάρι οι τρίβους βαβιούνται των εντολών, φάγονται ζωήραν γαλπαν γαλπίαν. Είπατε τις εύνεσιν ότι Κύριος εβασίλευσε και γαλ κατόρθωσε την οικουμένην, ή τη σους αλεφίσετε.
And we'll continue with the official slides. Tone 4. It's called Mixolydian by the ancient Greeks, and this tone is actually attributed to the poet, musician of ancient Greece, Sappho. Tone 4 is used in the well-known canon to the Theotokos, used on Fridays in Lent with the Akathist hymn, and in various Tropadia for Feast and Saints Day, such as the Tropadia of the Nativity, the Ascension, and the Annunciation. Tone 4 possesses a festive, dancing flavor, is joyous, and capable of expressing deep piety. What you see there is chanted in the Orthodox. It's done usually after the morning gospel has come out and venerated, when the priest actually comes and censors the church. It's also chanted in a different mode, of course, during the Paraklesis to Panagia, but usually starts off, it is meet and indeed and right, and so on. So this particular piece will be chanted, as I said, in tone 4.
Το στόμα μου και πληρωθήσετε πνεύματος και λόγον ερεύξω με τη Βασιλίδη Μήτρη και οφήσω με φεύρος πανηγυρίζων και ασογηφόμενος ταυτίστα θαύματα.
That last piece was actually from the canon to the Panagia during Lent, from the Kaphistos Hymnos. Moving on to tone 5, or plagial first, it was called Hypedvorion by the ancient Greeks. As we said before, plagial means to change or alter. And the most well-known example of tone 5 is the Ευλογητάρια in Όφρος. Also in tone 5, a Christ is risen from the dead, which is very familiar, and the Stichadia of Pascha, which is chanted during the resurrection of Όφρος as well. This tone is stimulating, dancing, and rhythmical. It is often the first tone learnt by students of Byzantine chant. I must make a little note here that tone 5 can also be quite sorrowful, depending on how it is actually chanted. There's actually two ways in which plagal first can be chanted. The first is the way I described here, stimulating, dancing, and rhythmical. And just to give you an idea of the scale, so you can actually hear the difference between sorrowful and joyful, hymns are written in two different scales or ways. So the first one, the sorrowful way, is from pa, so it's Παβουγαδίκε και βιγαβού πα. Whereas the stimulating or the dance joyful one actually starts from και. Και βικέζον υπάνιζο και. The piece we'll actually chant here tonight is the part of the two stichos from the two verses from the doxology, which again is chanted every Sunday. This particular piece actually starts from the joyful tone, so from ke. Second, or tone 6, is the one of the favorite tones of the Mid-Eastern chanters and one of the most difficult ones for students to actually learn. In ancient Greek, it was called Hypolyvian scale, and tone 6 was distinguished by its rich texture and generally sorrowful tone. It's very prevalent when chanting hymns during the funeral service, and it sort of lends itself to a, as I said, a more sombre setting. However, as you will actually hear, the Plagal Second also is one of the eight tones that is used for resurrection hymns. So it's quite a paradox, if you wish, between how you can apply a sorrowful tone to a resurrectional, which is happy. But again, that's where the sudden "Be This Witness" comes out of the actual music itself. Tone 7 was known as Ipophrygion by the ancient Greeks. The Tropalion for the Transfiguration is actually in Tone 7. It is distinguished by a manly character and a very, very strong melody. And as we mentioned before, according to the Greek church tradition, it's actually the melody, or it's believed to be the melody that the angels used to praise God. If, of course, we could actually hear the angels with human voices. The piece we're about to chant is two pieces from the from the Orthodox, as I said, and again a resurrectional character is actually prevalent.
Ανέστη Χριστός εκ νεκρών λύσας φανάτου τα δεσμά. Ευαγγελίζω γη χαράν μεγάλην, εν ήτε ουρανή Θεού την δόξαν. Ανάστασιν Χριστού θεασάμενη, προσκυνήσομεν Άγιον Κύριον Ιησούν, των μόνων αναμαρτητών.
And the last tone, Plagal Fourth, called also known as Ipomixolydian, there's a tongue twister for you, by the ancient Greeks. This is a favorite tone of the church and is heard in the Canon of the Cross, the Tropalion, or the Voxastico of the Holy Fathers, and the Tropalion of Pentecost. Ευλογητός η Χριστέ ο Θεός ημών. This tone creates an air of humility, tranquility, and repose, expressing in many cases suffering and pleading. This piece again is from the Orthodox. I know that sounds repetitive. This is again from the Pasapnoaria or Lauds, and it's towards the end of the Orthodox.
Thank you.
put in one that I didn't actually, just came to me now, actually, according to the notes I read. Plagal fourth, as you heard, actually starts from the ni. Ni, pa, vu, ga, vi, ga, vu, pa, ni, are the actual main note itself. In plagal fourth, there's two ways or two parts of the scale that is used against a diatonic scale. One is from ni, and the other one is from ga. Ni pavu ga, which is what the Ευλογητώσι Χριστέ, ο Θεός ημών, is actually chanted in, as well as the Παράκλησις της Παναγίας. So we'll just quickly chant Ευλογητώσι so you can actually hear it in practice. Thank you very much for being so attentive. I hope you forgive me for any mistakes or lapses in the text. I know we started a bit late, so we've got about 20 minutes, I think, for questions, if that's okay with Ava, till 9 o'clock. So feel free to ask any question. I'll do my best to answer it. I'm not the all, be-all and end-all of already on Byzantine chant, so if I don't know the question, I'll possibly pass it on to someone who does, or perhaps at the end you can leave some sort of email address, or we can... And I'll try and address it that way if you want. So the floor's open, as I say.
While the church doesn't promote, obviously, musical instruments in the divine liturgy, what instrument is there, however, that can play Byzantine notation accurately?
Yep, good question. Yes, there are instruments that can actually play all the nuances of Byzantine chant. These are mainly of a stringed nature, such as a violin or a cello. Clarinet, or clarino in Greek, can actually play Byzantine chant quite faithfully, and there are quite a few CDs available in the market that actually have transposed Byzantine hymns with instrumental music, so it opens itself to a wider audience perhaps. So yes, in short, there is.
Ξέρουμε ότι στην ευρωπαϊκή μουσική αν δεν έχεις φωνή, όσο και να γνωρίζεις, δεν μπορείς να γίνεις τραγουδιστής. Στη βυζαντινή μουσική υπάρχει καλλιέργεια φωνής.
Καλή ερώτηση. Θες να απαντήσω στα ελληνικά ή στα αγγλικά? Just for the benefit of the very, I'll answer that one in English. The gentleman was asking, in European music, if you don't have a voice, basically you can't become a singer. Is it the same in Byzantine chant, or is there some sort of galleria or a development of the voice? In short, the short answer to that one is limited development. In other words, if you have the talent of a voice... you obviously need a talent of a voice to be able to chant, just exactly the same as European music, there's no difference. The one thing that makes a difference, as I said before, is the actual nuances or the difference in tones and the way you have to use or throw your voice at times, which can make it difficult for people that are used to Western music only. However, if you sit down with a credible teacher, if you're only slightly off, and it's up to the experience of the teacher that actually hears you, and that's the best way to do it, a one-on-one thing, they may say to you, well, with practice, and we'll practice the scala for argument's sake, your voice may actually become attuned to that scale. So, yes, limited, depending obviously how developed or undeveloped your voice is, and actually if your teacher or the potential teacher sees any possible potential in you on it. So, yeah.
Lambros, with the classes that you give at Bentley, when new people start at varying times, can that occur, or do they all have to start at a particular time?
The The classes that we've been running at the Bentley Parish, as I mentioned before, has been going for approximately 2 years. We are currently in the stage where we are trying to develop, as new people become interested every year, to start off a new class. It's a little bit hard, and we don't exclusively say no to people to join us, say, halfway through, but it is very hard to catch up, especially as our resources are limited with teachers. And also, once you get beyond a particular stage in the actual theory, it's very hard for a new beginner. So the best thing is to try and start one group at one time so that everybody's basically on the same page. But I think the second part was, can people join? Yes, anytime. I'm actually, in my humble opinion, I think we need to actually form more of these. I'll use schools in inverted commas because it's not a school, it's more of a study group, but in different parts of Melbourne to make it accessible for everybody, basically. And I think it's a real need here in Australia for something like that to take place, where I'm hoping it's not a dying art. I'd like to think it's not a dying art. I'd like to hope that it's a flourishing art itself. And if you can, let me just quickly put a parenthesis on your question. Yesterday we actually held a concert at the Auctionisty Parish, the Monastery of Auctionisty. Approximately 20 young people, young chanters of Melbourne took place, which is encouraging, which means that, yes, there are... Byzantine music is a living tradition, and if anything of yesterday is to go by, we're in for a good future, but we need to maintain it. We can't just sit back and just let it think that it's just going to develop on its own, basically.
Thank you.
If anybody wants to and is interested, at the end I'm happy to take names of those that may want to attend as a potential students next year at the Bentley Parish. And we are currently in negotiations, or we're trying to structure a third class and a third resource to be added, but I'm happy to take names from whoever's interested.
Thank you, Lambro, for your talk tonight. There's one sort of question, I suppose it's a footnote to what you say, is because the flexibility of Byzantine music is such that there are many different interpretations within it. Now, of course, when someone goes to Psalty to learn, this particular techni, this God-given techni, he in effect adopts the rhythms of the teacher himself. Now, speaking for myself, it can be quite confusing because some teachers use the interpretations of Karamani and others Tagliadoros and so forth, and it can be quite difficult. How can we sort of overcome this? Which interpretation do you follow, for example?
Okay, multi-layered question, thank you. Just to perhaps explain Vasily's question, when he refers to his names, Karamani, Stalyavodos, they're actually composers of Byzantine chant, current composers of the last century, who have taken the existing hymns, obviously, and added their own interpretations of them. I wish there's many things I left out of my talk, obviously. This is one of them, but yes, in a nutshell, each chanter does have his own style and uses a particular book. In Melbourne, it seems that Karamani's interpretation, let's put it that way, who was a famous chanter in Thessaloniki and, as I said, has written his own books. Just to show you one example of one of his books for the Orthodox service, each composer adds their own little nuances in the music. So I take the basic text for what it is and then write it usually according to what their vocal capabilities are and how they feel they express the theology of the piece best. The easiest way, I think, to overcome that for anyone that has gone with a teacher is to try and go back to the classics, is my own humble opinion. When I say the classics, I'm talking about the pieces as they were originally written. After I talked about the reform of the new teachers in about 1840 to 1820, a lot of pieces from before that, from the, say, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, were put down officially by the church as pieces to be chanted, of composers such as Petros Lambavarios, Grigorios Protopsaltis, and so on, Phokaios. All these are just names of composers. Now, the thing that differentiates these older composers to the newer is that they have kept the surface of the chant or the interpretation a lot simpler in the way that the inflections of the voice are meant to be used. Not that they are not there, but someone at a relatively beginner stage can chant them and follow it exactly as the interval signs are actually written. For the more advanced, there are actual interpretations of the notes in there that indicate what type of inflection, how to throw your voice perhaps. So it's a multi-layered, so it caters for the beginner to the very advanced, and it sounds great from both. I think the limitation with the newer composers, and it doesn't matter who it is that they have written it, as I said, to their own, to suit their own voices, their own musical talents, and I think in some ways it becomes a little bit restrictive in who can actually chant it. It's very hard to pick up, for arguments like a Karamanis piece, even for an advanced psaltin, and chant it perfect without starting at first, whereas a classical piece is a little bit easier to do that. So my own humble opinion is start from, or go back to the classics, study the classical composers. It's like saying Mozart or Wagner or things like that, from the European side of things. And you'll find that you actually become, I think, a more grounded chanter and can actually concentrate on the texts rather than the throwing your voice around, because many times they become so complex in the way they are written that it detracts, I think, from the meaning. I'm not trying to put them down because they have beautiful pieces in their own right, and I chant from Karamanis, occasionally. I started with Karamanis when I first started on the Logio, like everybody, I think, like a lot of chanters in Melbourne. But recently I found myself going back to the source material, where these have been adapted. They're basically adaptations of the original sources. And I find that it's actually helped me a lot to ground myself as well in that. So that's my own, as I said, my own opinion. If you ask somebody else, they might have something different.
In your answer, you actually raised a very important point that we should highlight, is the fact that the objective of church music is trying to find that careful balance between logos and melos, in the fact that having traveled as I have and having seen other interpretations of the music, I'm particularly thinking of the Middle East now, where they do like to sort of throw in what we would call in Greek a movement called ecstasis or tarab, as they call it, whereby they sort of play with the rhythm and emphasize the second plagal tone. How much of a temptation is it to sort of overemphasize the melody against the words, being a psalty of your sort of stature?
So I'm not a psalty of any stature, to be honest. It's a God-given talent. I'm trying to exercise it as best as I can. But to your point, you've opened a literal can of worms there. There's something called the sickness of all chanters. And that is a spiritual sickness, which is called the ego. It's very, very easy for a chanter, to even one of limited stature or capabilities, to get carried away with a particular melody of a piece, that you start after a while, I think, to be carried away by how much you can actually vocally exercise your throat or your vocal cords and see how many nuances you can throw in there to make it more complex. Complex isn't always better, and the temptation is there. It's very real. I myself, I'll make a confession, have fallen to it at times. It is something that is a constant spiritual battle, and I think that's where confession and a spiritual life do help a chanter, because a chanter, yes, must be recognized as a musician, as a performer, on one worldly page, let's say. But on the other hand, they're also representing the people, and you are actually praying. You're meant to be praying on behalf of the people at the time. Now, if you're not able to pray because you're getting carried away by the melody, you may lose the focus or the attention span of the people, and they start concentrating on your so-called vocal exercises. And that's something that is best avoided, because that's not the role of the chanter at all. So it's a constant battle, and it must be fought very, very hard to try and overcome it.
I just wanted to ask about how do you transfer the richness of the Byzantine chanting to English? How does that work?
Good question. Again, multi-layered. The truth must be told. English is a poor cousin of the Greek. I need to be blunt about it. You can't convey the richness of the poetry, the Greek poetry, which is what the language of the church was originally conceived it, very easily, and convey that meaning properly in English. But in having said that, obviously the reality is we live in an English-speaking country. we're slowly becoming assimilated into the culture and into the national identity of Australia. So yes, there is obviously a need to transpose, and already there's been a lot of work done in America, because obviously a few generations ahead of us in terms of transposing. Now, there are difficulties in doing so, to try and fit, because don't forget, poetry has a certain structure. Now, to try and convey that structure that those pieces were written in into the English and trying to get away in the words is obviously, but there are a lot of resources that have been written in Byzantine chant in English and actually sound very, very nice itself. So they do exist. They have been working on them for a very long time to try and overcome those problems of translation and fitting the music properly to the piece, and to convey the meaning of the text properly. Many times I've had to change the music a little bit around, so it doesn't sound identical in some cases, but in most cases you probably wouldn't be able to pick it, especially coming from a professional, let's say, choir, chanting in English, that the sound will be very, very similar. It's just you lose, I believe, the richness of the actual meaning. And even I've heard comments from people that are not of non-Greek background, that have no idea of the Greek language, and when you chant, or when they hear a CD or a piece in English and Greek, they actually prefer the Greek, not because of anything else, but they feel that the richness of the language and the feeling it actually evokes is a lot richer than what the English can do. So, you know, as I said, again, that's my own opinion. I think it's up to us to hold on to the Greek language as best as we can. Again, this opens up a different side of things, but just really quickly, I need to touch on this point, I think. There's plenty of materials that the divine lineage has been translated into English many, many years ago. It's readily available for everybody, even free off the internet. I think we need to do our best to try and keep the Greekness, at least of the divine liturgy. Everything else, like, you know, your baptisms, weddings and everything, you cater obviously to the people that you're actually performing it for, or performing in inverted commas, of course, or doing it for, and you need to think. But I personally believe, as a chanter, in my limited stature as a chanter, that you can't convey the beauty of the chant as well as you can in the Greek language. And I think we need to keep that and try and keep the Greekness, because the Greekness is not only about national identity at the end of the day. It's what was chosen by God himself. It's actually a God-inspired language. It was set up from the beginning to be able to translate his word into human form for us to be able to glorify him. So it'd be a shame if we lose it, not for nationalistic identities or as Greeks, but think of the unbroken tradition from 2,000 years ago all the way through to today. It'd be a shame if it's just broken off and abandoned for a poorer language is how I say it. But thank you for the question.
Sorry for saying this, but the Greeks, that sort of sounded a lot like the ancient Israel, who thought themselves to be more superior than others. Okay, and God gave the Greeks, who were pagans, who were very intelligent, the chance to become his people.
That's a good question.
Okay, and I think that we as Greeks, as Orthodox Christians, must be careful not to cross over a very fine line, because it is, for someone who is non-Greek, that is an extremely hurtful thing to hear.
I do apologize if I caused any offense. I didn't mean for it to come out.
No. I just think from a spiritual perspective, that as long as there is respect both ways.
Yeah, of course. And I'm not saying
to respect for, because I agree that the Greek language is a treasure. But I think that when you're presenting the Greek language to non-Greeks, they want to hear that the Greeks have respect for their language too.
I'm not saying to completely ignore one language over the other. That's of all. Course, it has to be a fine balance between the two, and that's what I'm saying, yeah.
Because I'm only half Greek. I mean, my mum's Greek, but my father's Croatian. And it's really sad to sort of feel as if, you know, and English is my first language now. I mean, I did speak Greek when I was little, but English is my first language. And when I hear those things, I feel as if my mother tongue is cheap. And that makes me feel really sad.
Yeah, look, it's obviously a very complex issue, and I'm only touching the surface really here. I'm not trying to put over that the Greek language is the only language and nothing else should be used. Obviously not. All I'm saying is us Greeks have a tendency to look at it from a nationalistic point of view, and we are the chosen people and so on. That's not my...
So did ancient Israel.
Yeah, and so did ancient Israel.
You
have
to be careful.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to... I'm hoping I'm not conveying that meaning, and I don't want to convey that meaning to people. All I'm saying is it's nothing to be... We need to try and step away from a nationalistic or an identity of Greeks. Just because we're Greek, we should be chanting in Greek. No. We need to view Greek for what it is as a language and try and see it as third-party observers, not for anything else.
No, I agree. Yeah. That just as long as there is respect both ways.
Yes.
I mean, because the English have shown great respect to the Greek language by adopting so many of their words.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay, they could have chosen more Latin words, but they had such a respect for the Greek language. They do use it. And I just feel like this country has given us so much. And, you know, and I think that we should show a bit of gratitude for the good things that this nation has given us.
And I'm hoping I'm not implying anything
no,
but
no,
that.
No. I know exactly where you're coming from. You know, as I said, like, I'm not saying
no,
that
you're
the
absolutely
Greek
correct.
Language is, it is beautiful, you know. But I just feel that that the two should need to coexist because the fact that the next generation of young people don't speak Greek very well, and they're the lost children of the house of Israel. Okay, and we need to reach to them. So if by respecting the English language, the English will respect the Greek and actually probably love it a lot more.
Cooperative balance as
yes.
such, yeah.
Yes, that's all I want
thank
to say.
No, thank you.
I just wanted to add to that conversation you guys were having. I think what Lumbra was trying to say is that because Byzantine music was formed around Greek language, it's very difficult to transpose the Greek words into the English language. As Lumbra said, the poetry doesn't match. It's very hard to have the beautiful flowing of the Byzantine music with the English language. I think that's what you were trying to say.
It's a cold, hard fact. I'm not trying to be nationalistic, as I said before. It's a cold, hard fact that when you've got, a language, and I'm only using the Greek, obviously, an example, any language that has, and this is just off the top of my head, 16 or 17 million words from the ancient Greek, and then you've got a vocabulary of 48,000 words of which English, which is a hybrid language at the end of the day between Latin and Greek, mainly, it is very, very hard to try and fit. It's like trying to squeeze, a big... a load of rocks into a truckload of rocks into your hatchback. I don't know why I used that example, but yeah, if you know, I think you catch my drift. I mean, it's reached the stage now where professors and of language and IT and computing and science have run out of English words to be able to explain theories, and they've actually started programming your computers, and this is a fact, in the ancient Greek language to cope with all the complex calculations of they're actually doing. As I said, once again, I'm not trying to be, but yes, it is true. It's the cold, hard facts. You've got to weigh one up the other, but they can coexist, and they do coexist, and that's why it's been developed.
You're talking purely musically, though.
Musically only.
Not in terms of language.
No, my perspective is from a music perspective only. That's all.
Yeah, because like the Orthodox Church also includes Russian language.
It does.
And Croatian.
It's not Greek Orthodox, it's Orthodox. Russian
That's
Orthodox,
correct,
Serbian.
Yeah.
Serbians use Byzantine chant. Arabs use Byzantine chant.
That's right.
And it's all based on Nipavugavi, the Greek. And they just adapted it into their own language, of course. And this is what we're slowly starting to do with the English language as well.
I'd just like to say that years ago, I don't know what happens now, we all studied Shakespeare at school. Do they still study Shakespeare at school? And I remember I absolutely loved Shakespeare. I had an English teacher who had a real zeal for Shakespeare. And part of the Shakespeare wasn't just the storyline and the characters. It was actually the language that was used. And I remember years ago, before I became a nun, I travelled with my parents overseas. And we went to Stratford-on-Avon in England and saw one of the Shakespeare plays. It was absolutely brilliant, with an English accent, played out in an open-air theatre to see actually Shakespeare done. It was beautiful. Then I got a cousin in Paris. So I go and visit my cousin in Paris, and he wanted me to go and watch Shakespeare in French. And I said, no way am I going to wreck Shakespeare by watching it in French. So this was years ago. We went and watched E.T. instead. So because Shakespeare was written by Shakespeare in the language of the time, That's the only way as I can explain about our church language. The New Testament was written in Greek, and our Byzantine hymnographers wrote the poetry of our hymnography and the theology to the Byzantine chant with the Greek language. So it's really hard to change it into something else. I couldn't put our thing in Shakespearean English or ordinary English, but we need the English here in Australia to be able to understand. So what I when I went to Greece, I'd have the Greek text next to me and the English text next to me. We need the English text so we can understand it. It's quite heavy, the theology behind it. Just think of Shakespeare. You can't have it in French. Okay? If anyone loves Shakespeare like I do, or any poetry, any of the poets, you can't change their poetry to put it into a modern-day language. So didn't they have Romeo and Juliet in a modern... Did they do it with modern language? I thought someone said there was a movie of Romeo and Juliet. It was in modern thing. Did they do a modern language or did the old language? Modern language. I wouldn't want to go and see it. And actually, so...
Thank you, Elsa.
That might help us understand that this stuff was originally written in Greek, so the poetry of the words and the theology of the words and the melody, those three aspects are all tied in together. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Just a last conclusion, just to finalise it all. As I mentioned before, if anyone is interested in leaving me their email address, is probably the easiest way to do it. Either if they're interested in learning how to chant, or they would like some more resources as to whether I can go on the web and actually research this music in a little bit more in depth, or if I want to access sound files of proper choirs that exist. A choir is a choir, and when I say proper choir, I'd like to say a professional choir, perhaps, that has been doing it for many years. As you heard, the girls and boys tonight, as I said, are actually first and second year students, with the exception of one, the other teacher, Presbyteros Stavdula, who happens to be my sister, funnily enough. I'd like to say thank you to Father Peter as well for making the parish available, and I hope for a long time to come for this study. But I encourage any chanter who has learned this beautiful music to actually pass it on to other people, because otherwise, from a living tradition, becomes a dying tradition, and that's something we want to... thank you for your patience. Thank you for listening to me. I apologize for any misunderstandings or any ellipses, things that I've missed out on. There is a lot of things I missed out on, and I realized that afterwards, but my time was not limited because I had plenty of warning, but due to time constraints with other things, I was unable to do it exactly, but I think hopefully you got some sort of overview on what Byzantine chant at least is on a surface level. So thank you.
I'd just like to make some announcements. Just before I do, just like to thank Lambro on behalf of all of you this evening. I think Lambro and the choir that he brought with him this evening, who I've never heard before, by the way. I've never heard that choir before. I knew you were... Oh, it's the first time they've been in public. Okay, well, that's why I haven't heard them. That's a good reason. But I was very impressed. I think you would have been too. But I think what came out of tonight, for me anyway, Lambro, was that you emphasized to us that the chanting of the church is not just music. It's the vehicle of conveying our belief, our faith, our theology. And music is the vehicle of that. And the chant is part of it. It's not just music. It's not entertainment as such, as beautiful as what it is. And you may notice when you look at the church's books, like the services, liturgy and whatever, notice that the parts that we've become accustomed to hearing the chanters do is labeled laos, people. So as Lambro also mentioned this evening, the chanters are meant to be those who are leading the congregation in prayer and worship. So really they're doing your work on behalf of you, and you are meant to follow with them. Now, as the chanting has become more intricate and complex through the centuries, obviously that's probably why we've just let them do their thing. For example, our chanter here in South Melbourne, he goes very high, so people just simply can't sing with him. Okay, so they don't. So I've come to a realization after being here for many years, that is the main reason why the people in South Melbourne don't follow our chanters, because the vasi, the basis of the notes, the foundation, is so high that people simply cannot follow, particularly the women in the women's ranges of voice, simply can't go that high. So they just don't. They let the chanters do it. And because that's been going like that for decades, people have just become accustomed to, we'll let the chanters do their bits and we'll listen. To actively participate in our services, however, doesn't mean necessarily to be singing along with the chanters. To actively participate means a meaningful following of what's happening. So even if nothing's coming out of our mouths, our mind, our heart, and our soul can be spiritually in tune and in harmony with the chanters. That's what it means to actively participate. The services, you know, are dialogue. The priest, the chanters, antiphonal, the whole bit. But we are meant to be part of that dialogue, every single one of us, not just the priest and the chanters. So thank you, Lambro, for elevating us to the heavens this evening with the choir. One thing I'd like to ask you later, if you've got time to stay in the hall, because I think there'll be a lot of people who may have more questions, and I think it'll be good for them to ask. I'd like you to help me. This is when we're talking about Greek English. I've always found it difficult to chant the word in English, grace. Grace. Now, don't get me wrong. English is my first language, so I'm not ridiculing English in saying that. But I've never been able to chant the word grace. I'd like to hear you do it later. And just give me a few little tips, you know. Grace. The word, think about it. You try it on your own at home, okay? Even though you can't sing very well, try singing the word grace. It's very hard. It's very hard. It's just the nature of the syllable. It's the way it is. Through the prayers of our holy fathers, Lord Jesus Christ, our God, have mercy on us and save us. Amen. May God bless you all and keep you well. And may you have a very holy and blessed Christmas.